Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. How do you start talking about sex with teenagers, with a 12-year-old girl even? The term hookup culture, do you talk about that? Depending on what day you open the opinion section of the paper, the hookup culture is either the worst thing in the world or the most liberating thing in the world for young women. Either way, one truth is this. The major increase in premarital sex happened with the baby boom generation. Kids these days are not having more sex, but things have indeed changed. Here to talk about those changes and what parents might be aware of is Peggy Orenstein, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Maybe you remember her bestseller, Cinderella Ate My Daughter. Her new book, now that her girl is 12, is Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Hi, Peggy. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
So did you write this book primarily for parents listening who, like yourself, acknowledge that it's uncomfortable to talk explicitly to their 12-year-olds or older?
So uncomfortable. Yeah, so awkward, as the girls would say. I've been writing about girls for 20 years, but I'm also a mom. And I'd been hearing these stories about the hookup culture and about binge drinking and about sexting and about ubiquitous porn. And, you know, as a parent, there's part of you that wants to just hide your head in the sand and not deal. But parenting from ignorance and fear is never really a great idea. So what I wanted to do was go out and talk to girls. I talked to girls between age 15 and 20, hear what was going on with them, hear what their attitudes were, and bring that back to really pull the curtain back and open the conversation among parents and among parents and girls.
That's good. You stay a few years ahead of your own daughter, and then you'll be really ready after your research.
Well, that's it, right? I need to know what I need to do. So I like to go out and talk to, you know, a couple hundred people and figure it out.
So listeners with teenage girls, or maybe if you recently had teenage girls, what's the hardest part of this? Or if you've been through it, what advice would you hook up with Peggy Orenstein to share with other parents with respect to getting through this in the way that most serves your kids? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Part of your book is a takedown of sex ed, the way it's taught.
Yeah. Well, you know, abstinence only, we have spent $2 billion on that in our country, and we might as well have set that on fire for all the good it's done.
It has not set the money on fire.
Set that money on fire because it has not reduced pregnancy. It has actually increased disease rates. You know, keeping our kids ignorant does not keep them from exploring their sexuality. And when I say sex, I'm not just talking about intercourse. And I think that's one of the really big takeaways from this book, is that we need to be talking to our kids not just about intercourse, but about the whole range of behavior, including oral sex, because that's where there's been a really big change. And by not talking about that, we're making it not sex to them, and we're opening the door for coercion, disrespect, and lack of reciprocity.
But do you think that's where American public education landed after those big debates of the 80s and 90s over abstinence only versus abstinence plus?
No.
I don't think they're teaching abstinence only primarily in the public schools, are they?
They are in some of them. In a lot of states, particularly in the South, they're still teaching abstinence only. Yeah, they are. And even in comprehensive classes, I mean, only 13 states mandate that sex education be medically accurate. And one of them, I'm from California, and one of them is my state, but it wasn't until last year that a judge found that the school district of Clovis, California, was in contempt of, was violating that law because they were making kids watch films that said that an unmarried woman who has sex is like a dirty shoe, and having kids chant the anti-gay, this is in public school, chant the anti-gay slogan, one man, one woman, one marriage.
So the big example you give of a better alternative system is in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Partly because of how schools teach sex ed, and partly because some parents let teenage boys and girls have sleepovers. You think that's a good idea?
I know the sleepover, that's a tough one even for me. But I'll tell you what really sold me on the way that the Dutch do it is when they look at comparisons of how American girls and Dutch girls in college talk about their early sexual experiences, the Dutch girls' outcomes are so much better. They have fewer negative outcomes, fewer pregnancies, less regret, less disease, and they have more positive outcomes. They contracept more. They enjoy sexuality. They can talk to their partners. You know, all these things we want for our kids. And the biggest difference is that they talk explicitly to their children. And the parents, they're both American and Dutch parents are equally comfortable talking about sex, but American parents only talk about risk and harm, and Dutch parents talk about how to balance joy and pleasure and responsibility.
Huh. So how likely is it that something like the Dutch model could take hold in the United States, considering that this country has whatever, however you want to define the values or maybe the diversity of values that we have in this country?
Well, I think we can make change. You know, I have a great belief, or I wouldn't be a writer, in the power of books to start conversations. And I always liken it to, you know, the food movement with Michael Pollan's books. That before that, who heard of free-range chicken? Who heard of factory farms, right? And now not everything has changed. Not everywhere has changed. But there has been substantive change in many people's lives and ideas.
Carrie in Eastchester. You're on WNYC with Peggy Ornstein. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. So nice to be on your show. I have two teenage daughters, and this is obviously a topic that I'm concerned about. And I have tried in the past to bring up the subject, and I just get the hand in my face.
Right.
Mom, don't even. I'm not going to talk to you about this. Please, I know it all. That's what they say. I know. What do you think? I'm stupid? That's the response that I get. And I'm really just looking for sort of a precursor or an initial statement or phraseology that I could use, or examples, basically.
Mm-hmm. You know,
break the ice.
This is really why I wrote this book, was that I was hoping that parents could give it to their daughters and read it themselves, and that it's a way to talk to kids without having to use your personal, awkward, embarrassing experience, but to say, hey, you know, I'm seeing a lot of non-reciprocal oral sex going on in this book. You know, what's going on in your world? Or there's an example that I give of this girl where I say, because we're talking about this issue of non-reciprocal oral sex, if guys kept asking you if you wanted to go get them a glass of water from the kitchen every time you were together and never offered to get you a glass of water, you wouldn't stand for it. And she laughed and she said, you know, I never thought about it that way. And I said, so you are more insulted when somebody asks you for a glass of water than when they ask you for oral sex. You know, and so there's just like ways, and there's things in there to help break that ice.
So it sounds like being very open and taking a very liberal stance, which I think is probably difficult for a lot of parents.
You're so right.
To face, especially in the culture, for example, where my kids go to school. None of that exists, I have to say.
Right.
I don't think it does.
Why it's so important. And, you know, the other thing I talk about, which is something that I got from one of the sex educators I talked to, was this idea that sex is like a pizza. We tend to talk about sex as, you know, a vertical line and talking about the bases. But if you shift that metaphor and say sex is like a pizza, and a pizza is something you share between two people. Nobody's trying to win when you order a pizza. And maybe, you know, you go halvesies, or maybe you do, you know, have pepperoni this time and sausage next time. Or if somebody constantly wants pepperoni and you hate pepperoni, you stop having pizza with them. You know, I mean, you can take that metaphor anywhere.
Carrie, thank you so much. And along those lines, you give an example of a sex ed teacher talking to her class about communication. And she says it is super sexy to get consent.
Yeah, it's so great to see her stand up in front of, you know, I end the book very particularly and consciously in a coeducational classroom, because while the book is about girls and sex, boys are part of the equation too. And so her standing up there and going, you know, you just say, you don't have to pull out a contract. You just say, hey, you okay? Hey, this feel good? You know, it's okay. And it models that for them. And one of the boys at one point, talking about this baseball metaphor again, he stopped and said, I never thought about it before, but in baseball, one person's the winner, one team's the winner, and one team's the loser. So who's supposed to be the loser when you're having sex? And for, you know, to me, that was like a miraculous moment, because that boy will take that perspective shift into every relationship he goes into. And that's fabulous.
Peggy Ornstein with us, her new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. And Kylie in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kylie.
Hi. So I explained to the screener, I'm an aunt, not a mother, but I am very close with my 15-year-old niece, and actually just had this conversation with her a couple of weeks ago. And what I find to be really, really complicated was exactly what your guest was just saying, like balancing the joy and responsibility. So I want to let her know, like, there are going to be people that you're going to have these very deep feelings about, and your body's going to want you to do these things. And, you know, that's great and that's natural, but there are real, real, like, there are real implications of your actions. And so you can't get pregnant. Like, that's a big, that would be a big problem. I would be very disappointed. And so trying to balance all of that to a 15-year-old who is, like, very 15 is just, I found that to be really challenging. So I'm wondering, how do you address, like, yes, you should experience this joy and responsibility, but there's, like, a really big, there's a big risk, and there's not that many options once that risk, you know, if that happens.
Right. And I think it's very important to talk to kids really clearly and explicitly about contraception and about disease protection. But one of the ways that we can really help girls is to also give them a sense of personal agency in their sexual encounters. So, you know, I'm really glad that you called us an aunt with a 16-year-old, because I am also the aunt of a was the aunt of a 16-year-old. She's older now. And I was the one who had that talk with her, too, when she was, I knew, contemplating intercourse with her boyfriend at the time. And, one, you know, in addition to all those things you just mentioned, I said, hey, look, I know you're contemplating this, and let me just, you don't have to answer these questions, but let me just ask them. And I'll tell you, I wanted to fall onto the floor while I was saying this, but I made myself say it. And I said, look, have you ever masturbated? Have you had an orgasm on your own? Have you had an orgasm with your partner? Are you able to talk to him about what you like and don't like? And if those things are not true, why are you thinking about having intercourse? You know, because that's a really great, good, kids rush towards intercourse. And you have to ask, like, who is more experienced, sexually experienced? The person who has intercourse drunk because they're trying to get rid of their virginity, or the person who is sober and kisses their partner for 3 hours and learns about erotic tension and, you know, affection and, you know, sexiness that way?
Do you think that it's easier for aunts to have the conversations? We heard the caller earlier, and we can all relate to this if we've had kids, that the kids put up their hand, say, no,
right.
I'm just
talk
not
to
going
the hand,
there,
right?
If you can kind of, in some cases, if you have the right kind of family situation,
yeah,
recruit an aunt or an uncle?
I think that if you have that kind of family situation, it's a great option, because sometimes it is hard. And that was what happened. My sister-in-law said, would you please take my daughter out to lunch, because she doesn't want to talk to me. And I think she'll, you know, you've got a step of remove and you can talk to her. And I will tell you something else about that. That girl is now in her mid-20s, and we have an incredibly close relationship, and we talk about everything. So this was not just like this scary thing that we have to talk about our kids with. It's an opportunity to create closeness and intimacy with the girls in your life, and to support them and make them feel like they can come to you, not just now, but forever.
The subtitle of your book is Navigating the Complicated New Landscape. Of course, sex is as old as humanity. I want to play a clip from Saturday Night Live from 1993 to set up a question. This is about the consent rules at the time at Antioch College.
May I compliment you on your halter top?
Yes, you may.
It's very nice. May I kiss you on the mouth?
Yes, I would like you to kiss me on the mouth.
May I elevate the level of sexual intimacy by feeling your buttocks?
Yes, you have my permission.
May I raise the level yet again and take my clothes off so that we could have intercourse?
Yes, I am granting your request to have intercourse.
Contestant.
Date rape.
So that's skit making fun of consent rules, which in a way feels outdated, but in a way feels very contemporary.
Yeah.
Was, you know, making fun of liberal thinking at the time, liberal in terms of making sure there was consent every step of the way. You write in the book that Camille Paglia called the concept of date rape BS. That was probably the 1980s,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what's new in the landscape?
Well, you know, there has been where consent is concerned, one of the reasons I wrote the chapter the way that I did on consent was I wanted to give that historical context and show what's been going on since the 1980s and 1990s and the ways that the anti-assault movement rose up and was really smashed down by the mainstream media, including Saturday Night Live. That was like the nail in the coffin, that skit. It was amazing how effective that was. And then, you know, what has changed for activism is that girls now no longer have to really depend on the mainstream media. And this round of activism has really come up through social media. And people are paying a lot more attention. And yes, we are still arguing and debating about what consent is. But everybody recognizes now that we have a problem.
And so that's what's new, is that more people recognize?
Well, that's what's new in that, you know, one of the things that's new there. But I think there's a number of things that are new. One of the things is the way that we the whole idea of hot is someplace where there's been a big shift. So hot is, you know, such a narrow, superficial, commercialized idea of what's sexy and what's attractive. And it tells girls over and over that how your body looks to other people is more important than how it feels to you. And an earlier generation of educated, you know, feminist identifying girls would have protested that as self-objectification. But today's young women are just as likely to take it on as a statement of empowerment and self-confidence. So at one point, but it's tricky. It's tricky and it's complicated. And at one point I was talking to a girl who showed me a picture of herself in, you know, a little crop top and a little skirt and said, "I'm proud of my body. And I never find it, there's no time that I feel more liberated than when I'm wearing skimpy clothes." And then a few minutes later she said, but if she gained a few pounds, she'd be reluctant to wear that outfit because boys might make fun of her and call her, she said, you know, a fat girl. And so you have to talk to girls and say, which bodies, who gets to be proud of which bodies, under what circumstances, and how liberating is it if you fear that humiliation lurks just around the corner?
I think it's been extremely liberating for a lot of people to hear you talk so clearly and openly on these subjects, and it is, of course, just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
In the new book, Girls and Sex, Navigating the Complicated New Landscape, by Peggy Orenstein, who's also a New York Times contributor, and maybe you knew her previous book, Cinderella Ate My Daughter. Tonight at 7, Peggy Orenstein will be reading from this book at the Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side. If you want to go and hear more from her, talk more to her, 82nd and 83rd on Broadway on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Peggy Orenstein tonight at 7. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.